Welcome to the Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards. The Reimagining Podcast is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which includes the Baltimore Wisdom Project and the Chicago Wisdom Project. Our shared mission is to reimagine education and reimagine the world by enhancing the lives of youth and adults with holistic education, intercultural understanding, and anti-oppressive, liberationist thought leadership.
Culture always creates a holistic vision of cosmos, community, and self. Through symbol and story, a narrative comes together that tells us how we came to be and how we belong. The context for this vision changes, but the holistic nature of it does not. The scope of this vision may be smaller, but it's always a vision for the entire cosmos. This is how worlds are made. Each vision is, as long as it is fully developed and integrated into the culture, equally accurate, holistic, and cosmic. But wait, you might ask, how is the vision of an uncontacted tribe in the Amazon or an isolated island in the Pacific as all-encompassing as the 13.7 billion-year vision of modern science? Let's begin with the notion of accuracy. The best measure of a cosmology's accuracy is in how it helps to cultivate meaningful, sustainable relationships in its context. The context is the whole. For an uncontacted Amazonian tribe, their context is the area of the forest in which they live. There is a story that tells them their place in the world, and if it's a functioning culture, how they can live meaningful, ordered, and sustainable lives. For most of human history, the context for cultural narratives would have been fairly similar to those of the uncontacted Amazonians. Paradox that lies at the heart of religion and nature, and this is the question we are indeed grappling with right now, is how to retain a sense of our connection to the world around us, the world we can touch and feel and taste, and also to the world, planet, as a whole. This is, in many ways, the challenge that climate change has presented us with. Our cosmos is the planet now. We must consider the spaces in which we teach and learn and grow together are metaphors for the Earth as a whole. So the aim is to bring forth a narrative, a set of symbols that give rise to the sense of the planet as a whole as our basic context, our home. In other words, in the broadening of our world, those of us who have abandoned indigenous cosmologies of dualism or loneliness now must uncover a cosmology in which the Earth as a whole is the context for our process of discovery. So today I'm joined by a group of people who are interested in the planetary crises that we face, and also in taking a more integral approach to teaching, learning, and to education in general. We are a species in crisis. It isn't merely climate change, but we're in the midst of a web of interconnected crises. Whether we're talking about geopolitics, economics, or pandemic, or mental health, we can trace all of these different crises to a worldview, the basic story that gives an individual a sense of who they are, their place in the cosmos. And the solution to these crises lies not only in practical or political things, but in our reimagining of our sense of who we are and our place in the world. This is what we're going to call an integral approach to teaching and learning and to human development. It's an approach that is inherently holistic, relational, ecological, and one that addresses both the inner and the outer worlds, the psyche and the cosmos. So today I'm joined by five colleagues and friends. Missy Lauren has worked as an environmental activist and public interest lawyer in the San Francisco Bay Area since 1993. More recently, she shifted her focus and embarked on a master's in education in integral education and a PhD in philosophy and religion, both of which centered on the emerging field of ecozoic education. Missy, welcome to Reimagining.
Thank you so much.
Sam King is the project manager for the Journey of the Universe and a research associate with the Yale Forum on Religion and Ecology. Welcome, Sam.
Thanks, Theodore. Great to be here.
Carrie Crisp Vasquez spent a decade working on corporate sustainability initiatives in food, product supply chains, and women's economic empowerment. In 2018, she stepped away from that field and began a learning journey to understand the lineage of human thought that brought the Earth community to ecological imbalance. Carrie, welcome.
Thanks so much, Theodore, for having me.
Brian Pendle teaches high school English in St. Louis. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you, Theodore. It's great to be here.
And last but not least, Matt Switzer is a researcher, former middle school and high school teacher, and current doctoral student focused on philosophy, ecology, and religion. Welcome to Reimagining, Matt.
Yeah, great to be here.
So I'm going to start with you, Missy. And you've done a lot of work integrating philosophy into education for young people. I know that was one of the focuses of your doctoral research. So considering the tendency of philosophy in many schools towards being hyper-intellectual and anthropocentric, how can we teach philosophy to young people in such a way that there's a deeper interrelationship to the natural world?
Well, I'd like to just start by saying that I think academia treats philosophy like it's a luxury, when in my view, it's really a necessity. I think it's more important to our collective futures than math or English. And I didn't really understand how we had been sucked into a certain trajectory until I started graduate school in philosophy. And one of my professors, Rick Tarnas, showed us how we all ended up in this worldview of scientific materialism and patriarchy. And this all happened basically because we didn't know any better. And now we have all these systemic problems as a result. And I think everybody on this call pretty much agrees that integral education is a really viable solution. And so I'd start by saying, let's teach integral philosophy beginning in our very youngest grades. And let's introduce contemporary philosophers who actually wrote out their ideas to address this very moment in time. Philosophers like Thomas Berry, Brian Swim, Joanna Macy. I mean, they're eco-philosophers, and they wrote to be understood. They wrote to be accessible to everybody. And they got students asking, what's my worldview? How do worldviews actually impact reality? What's cosmology? What's a living cosmology? What does reciprocity look like? What duty should I have to future generations? And these philosophers were really inspiring because these are different questions than you might think are part of a traditional philosophy curriculum. So like Joanna Macy taught students to think with their bodies and their hearts, not just their minds. Berry basically taught us that it's okay to bring values and emotions into the classroom. Brian Swim connects story with science and teaches us a new way to understand like the evolution of the universe. And then there's psychologists like Howard Gardner and Daniel Goleman who broke open the entire field of academia with multiple intelligence theory. And this essentially gives teachers permission to experiment with all these other ways of knowing that Brian Swim and Joanna Macy and Thomas Berry helped us understand. And so, you know, with multiple intelligence theory, ecological is one of them. And those of us in the field can basically experiment with this, build lessons and open source them. I tried to do that in my own work and try and shift us out of an anthropocentric worldview by focusing on the five kingdoms of life when I wrote, so that students are actually inspired to learn about all the intelligences of the other species and then build solution-oriented inspirational content around that. So those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Missy. And I think what you said that was so important and so crucial to me was, well, you said a few different things. And I really would agree with you about the way that philosophy is approached so often. It is both elitist and also really kind of disembodied and like disconnected from natural processes. And I think that at its best, philosophy is about asking questions about certain basic assumptions we make. And I want to turn to Sam King with this, because Sam, your work has a lot to do with what we can call cosmic education. And I want to ask you about how your work in cosmic education or cosmology is a way of cultivating a sense of relationship to the whole and of understanding some of the basic assumptions we might make about who we are.
Absolutely. And so you spoke earlier to this idea that we have a crisis of story, that the prevailing narrative that is conveyed to young people through education is often one of individualism and competition and preparing young people to enter what the U.S. Department of Education calls a competitive global marketplace. And so my work in cosmic education has been trying to introduce young people to a deeper sense of story of where we come from, drawing on Thomas Berry's idea of the new story from his essay in 1978, and also Maria Montessori's idea of cosmic education, which she developed in the 1930s while in exile in India. And this is a larger sense of where do we come from the ultimate mysteries of the universe, from the great flaring forward to the formation of galaxies and stars and the solar system and the earth processes. And this kind of deep time perspective can help young people have a sense for where we've come from and to start imagining where we are going. I think young people are craving this sense of connectedness to a larger whole. And when we introduce them to an integral way of seeing their place in an earth community, it begins to unleash their own sense of imagination and creativity for how they might participate in what Joanna Macy calls the great turning, or for Thomas Berry, the great work. So as an example, I've been working with a local middle school called the Connecticut Experiential Learning Center, and they've been building a nature trail using native plants in connection to the story of the universe. So they have been actually preparing paintings that illustrate the different thresholds of the universe story and that are demarcated by native plants on a particular bioregion here in Connecticut. And this idea of connecting the microcosm or place-based learning to the macrocosm or the ultimate story of the universe. And these kinds of integral education have, in my view, great power to inspire creative, imaginative solutions to the greatest ecological and social crises of our time.
Thank you for that, Sam. And I think that understanding our sense of who we are as defined by a story or set of symbols is so important. I think it's something that we're often unaware of. You mentioned bioregionalism. I want to turn to Carrie Chris Vasquez about this, because I know a lot of your work, Carrie, has been around bioregionalism. And I'd like you to expand on that a little bit and go a little deeper in terms of talking about how, you know, where it's important to understand the big picture, it's also the power of understanding our specific place and how bioregionalism is important.
Yeah, thanks for that question. So first off, I'd like to just start by defining what a bioregion is. The etymology of the word means life place, but more specifically, you can think of a bioregion as a specific geophysical terrain. It's often bounded by a watershed. It has specific flora, fauna, soil, and climate. And it has very soft borders because landscapes do change over time. But these bioregions typically do not align with political boundaries. And there's also a cultural component of understanding of how to live in a specific place. So there's a very human consciousness dimension to it as well. It's interesting that for the last 500 years or so, there's been this planetary identity that's emerging, like with Copernican Revolution and Magellan circumnavigating the globe. But at the same time, there's also this profound dissociation with the Earth, right? And so there's almost like this loss of connection and cultural amnesia of the fact that humans and all the life on this planet are really born out of an integrated community. So what a bioregional approach does, I think the practical usefulness of it is that it can empower people to work in harmony based on the natural terrain and capacities of a specific place. And so this approach can also serve as an orienting philosophy for reintroducing place-based wisdom. And it can even re-sacralize nature and human cultures. And this can help to restore a sense of awe and wonder that we do emerge out of this integrated community. But I think it can also help us restore basic respect for the life-enabling ground that's literally beneath our feet. A bioregional approach was really based on the foundational concept from Aldo Leopold's land ethic. And he wrote that we abuse land because we regard it as a commodity belonging to us. But when we see land as a community to which we belong, then we begin to use it with love and respect. So bioregional approach attempts to really do three things. It tries to restore and care for ecosystems. It helps to share sustainable life practices. And it can help support the cultural work that's required for the transformation that's upon us. And so I think for particular cultures that are especially influenced by an industrial growth regime, there's this need to repattern humans back into nature. And a bioregional approach can help do that. One of the leaders in the movement was Peter Berg, and he came up with this amazing word called re-inhabitation. And that means to become fully alive in and with a place. So I'm working on an integral approach to re-inhabitation education to counter the dominant form of education that tends to prioritize individual achievement, cognitive skills, and objectivity. Those are all really important, but we also need to cultivate a deep interiority of the personal and collective levels, and also understand that we obviously live within the external boundaries of our planetary limits.
Yeah, thank you for that, Carrie. I think when we look critically at the broader worldview that lies at the root of, let's say, climate change, I think we also have to understand, and this is why we're focusing on education partly, because we have to understand that that world
worldview is played out in the classroom, and like the values of, say, capitalism are played out in the classroom as well. You spoke of individual achievement prioritized over relationship. And I think that that's not accidental or coincidental. That is the function of the worldview that informs our education systems, which then in turn inform the worldview. So I want to turn to Brian now, because Brian is an educator working in a classroom, and specifically ask about the role of literature, and which is a form of storytelling. We talked about the role of and the power of story in all of this. And I'd like to hear from you, Brian, about the work you do as an educator and the role of literature in addressing these kind of big questions and planetary crises.
Thanks, Theodore. I have a lot of thoughts here, and I might just start by naming some of the obstacles and challenges that I encounter in that role. I feel as an educator, I have a number of different obligations and allegiances that I'm always trying to balance. One is obviously my work as an educator in service of these larger visions and missions around addressing the world's crises and the role that I think education and educated people can play in that. But at the same time, I'm also balancing the very real need of my students to be able to leave my classroom and their schools with hard practical skills that they can apply and, you know, do all the normal getting a job and all that other work, while trying to instill in them this larger perspective and a greater sense of what their education is for. So it's that old story of working within existing structures, meeting the realistic demands they place on you while trying to fuse it and creatively interact with it with perspective for these larger goals. In terms of literature, if you think about it or ask, what's the appropriate genre for climate change? Some things that come first to mind are things like science fiction or dystopian literature, all these kind of literatures that sort of subconscious kind of relegate to the margins of what we consider, you know, human stories, right? These are the kinds of genres where things are twisted, they're a little less real. And the thing about climate change is it's subverting and challenging all those notions. But I worry right now in our sort of collective literary imaginations, it's still kind of boxed in those genres. And that can change our attitudes and perspectives towards it. The other thing that comes out of that is thinking about the role that setting plays in the stories we write and tell each other. The thing with climate change is it is the setting, and the setting is changing, and the setting is in crisis, where in most stories, that setting is taken for granted in this amorphous, impersonal black box in which the story happens. And then finally, I just wanted to talk about the role that I see reading and writing can play and teaching reading, writing can play. They are both inherently transformative acts. When you read a novel or any other piece of literature, you're a different person when you finished reading than when you started. And likewise, when you sit down to write something, the process itself is transformative and inherently creative. And what I love most about it is they force you to get in touch with your deep passional being, the part of you that is enmeshed in this world, enmeshed in relationships with this world, and your imagination and your dreams and possibilities. And by tapping into that, helping students tap into that, I think you tap into the essential source of newness and transformation that we need to solve the crises we're facing.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. You said a few things that really struck me, Brian. I think that for one, this notion that kind of dystopian literature or literature that might specifically make reference to climate change has sort of this like otherworldly quality at a time when things are changing so rapidly and so radically that many assumptions we might make about what is otherworldly and what is very hyper-realistic, that's also changing. And I also really thought that your point about the way that literature is brought forth through the imagination and in relationship, it's not just a thing on a page, but a thing that happens in relationship with, and that kind of relational sensibility is exactly the kind of ecological sensibility that's required. So that's a great way to think about literature, I think, in terms of this question. And so I wanted to also turn to Matthew Switzer as an educator as well. And I know, Matt, although you're not currently working as a teacher, you've taught history and politics and social studies. And I'm curious about your take on how you have addressed those things in your classroom or used those things in your classroom to address planetary crisis.
Yeah, well, thank you, Theodore, for bringing us all together here. It's been a lot of fun hearing everybody. Yeah, teaching's a hard thing. And I quit teaching primarily because I saw the glaring problem or huge assumption was that what we feel obligated to teach has anything of value in the first place. And to me, at least, it seemed like we hadn't really figured that out yet, right? And so all across the country, all across the world, there's all this conflict. And it's really that conflict which does teach us, and we learn through conflict. So in terms of addressing this crisis, you know, I think part of this teaching, part of this learning really involves sensitizing ourselves to the context, which means paying attention to what's beyond the classroom, right? And personal life, your neighborhood, your state and nation, your heritage, your all of these dynamics, right? Which are planetary and cosmological ultimately. And so learning really how the biosphere is disturbed by the effect of society and history and politics, right? Gets us interested in these things by understanding where there's tension and where there is crisis and conflict. So, you know, I think these subjects, right, social studies, history, right, help us learn the complexity of these wicked problems, the capacity to actualize our deeper potential in order to scale this up and outwards, and really be able to see this good society that, you know, seems to be a common goal in history, is really that we're engaged in the sustainable flow, right, of energy, and how to avoid collapse and injustice and suffering, and really learn to be a lineage holder and aligned with that creative capacity of the cosmos and life in these moments of transferring skills or techniques and ideas. So yeah, anyway, I just wanted to bring that really looking at the material experience, looking at, you know, what is culturally relevant knowledge, and also, you know, make the case that social intelligence needs to include natural intelligence and the role of teaching as sensitizing ourselves to new methodologies of knowing and epistemologies so that we can deepen into this holistic worldview and ultimately find positive ways to engage with the forces that might constrain our imagination. So finding conversations and supporting personal curiosity, I find, is, you know, really what teaching comes down to. Yeah, that happens everywhere. So glad it's happening here.
Yeah, thank you for that, Matt. And I think you touched really briefly on this idea of subjects, you know, as sort of like segregating different ways of thinking and learning into different categories, which has some value. And it's also at times can be problematic. And I think if we look at a question or a challenge, like say climate change, and think of it as not something that's merely scientific, but as something that we can look at through the lens of, say, literature, the lens of social studies, it helps to open up the possibility for one, that there are different ways of thinking through a problem, but also that there are different ways of addressing and different ways that we're all affected by it. I think that the notion that, say, natural systems are separate from human systems is something that's troubling and problematic. So we're going to take a quick break and then come back and open the panel up for some further conversation.
Reimagining is a place for people who believe that the stories of the modern world no longer sustain us, bringing us to the brink of catastrophe, ecologically, economically, spiritually. Our troubles cannot be solved merely through technology or even politics. Rather, we need to reimagine what it means to be human. We seek new stories, new poetics, new ideas, and we put our ideas and stories into action. This work requires the wisdom of those at the margins and by those with the courage to imagine a new world.
I'm joined today by a group of philosophers and ecologists and educators talking about integral education, an approach to thinking about teaching and learning and human development that addresses holistically some of the big questions we have as a species. And we're going to open up the panel now a bit. Missy Lauren, you had a question for Sam, I think.
Yeah. So Sam, you know, you just finished at Yale Divinity School and you have this master's, amazing degree, a master's in religion, and you also have classroom experience. And I'm really curious, are young people interested in exploring the various religions and spiritual traditions that are out there and actually constructing something that works for them? I mean, I perceive this as a trend among adults. It's something that I do. But is this happening among youth? And do you think school is an appropriate place to learn about religion and spirituality in general?
Absolutely. So I've had a longstanding interest in the place of spirituality and religion in education. And I taught philosophy and religion at an independent boarding school in the Connecticut Berkshires for 3 years before coming to graduate school. And young people are hungry for questions of meaning and belonging and trying to integrate the traditions of their youth, if they had a particular tradition or milieu that they grew up in, with what they're learning from the empirical sciences and from all these other influences that young people are often bombarded with in this information age. And so I think schools are a really important place for this process of meaning making. And now I recognize that in public education, speaking explicitly about religion and spirituality is very difficult. At the same time, many schools are embracing forms of mindfulness, social emotional learning, and reflection activities, which I think are really, really important to our conversations on integral education. In this holistic view of education, to allow students to really reflect on how the ideas they're encountering are shaping and transforming their own views of themselves and of the world. Because we owe young people an education that moves beyond simply the accretion of information. Young people are already bombarded with so much information. I think they're really hungry for how ideas matter and how they can integrate both traditions that are found in religious and cultural traditions historically with the emerging scientific worldview of cosmic evolution that we've been talking about today. I think in independent schools and after school programs and in charter schools, educators can speak a little bit more explicitly about religion and spirituality. But I think it really comes down to foregrounding reflection in the educational process and practicing the skill of metacognition for young people and really modeling that as an educator throughout the learning process. One of the reasons I'm so passionate about Journey of the Universe is it's weaving together the sciences of cosmic evolution with a sense of participation. What does it mean to be descended from exploded stars and to be evolved from early prokaryotes in the ocean deep, and allowing young people to really grapple with those questions? So it's not just something they encounter through an abstruse physics curriculum, something distant from themselves or just an objectified way of learning, but something that's embodied, participatory, and has a resonance that they can bring into their own life as they shape their own worldviews in response to the great challenges of our time.
Thanks for that, Sam. Sam, did you have a question for Carrie?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Carrie, you spoke about how education can resensitize learners to the bioregions that they inhabit and this bioregional approach to both educational and sort of community development. I know you share this other interest in social emotional learning. And I'm curious to hear you reflect a little bit more about how this connection to place can also deepen learners' sense of social and emotional learning.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Sam. So I think it's important to understand this question from within the broader educational landscape. And you alluded to this a little bit earlier, Sam, when you were talking about the U.S. Department of Education's mission, which is to promote student achievement and preparation for global competitiveness by fostering educational excellence and ensuring equal success. There are elements of that that are wonderful, and competition isn't necessarily a bad thing. But you can also see how, when taken to the extreme, that this can really speak to this worldview of hyper-individualism and zero-sum game thinking that underlies the neoliberal definition of success under which we live. And I think this model of education is very focused on outward results. You do well on tests, you outperform, you grow up and you get a job, and you basically replicate that model. So what I think social emotional learning does is it brings a much needed focus on the interdimensional space, and both in terms of the personal as well as the collective. So for example, there's a focus on self-management and also self-awareness so that people can learn to better regulate their emotions and behaviors. And it also focuses on social awareness, such as empathy toward others, how to form positive relationships, and also ethical and responsible decision-making. So from a bioregional perspective, how this could work or be employed is that you could learn about different cultural or religious differences in a particular place and then invite empathetic dialogue and discussion about that and reflection. And then in civics, you might even include historical information about cultural traumas that were experienced in a specific place. So it has a very tangible relatedness to it, such as I grew up in North Carolina and the Cherokee tribe was there and are still there, but there was a horrible genocide and displacement that took place in that place. And so I think helping people to engage in that kind of dialogue encourages social awareness. And that's part of what social emotional learning tries to do.
Thank you so much for that, Carrie. I think that it's so important to think about the kind of sort of interior and emotional aspect of every subject, as opposed to sort of like isolating social emotional learning as something separate from the subject matter. So I really liked how you addressed that. Did you want to ask a question?
Yes, I do. I have a question for Brian. I wondered, have you explored any eco-poetic practices with your students? And what I mean by that is just poetry that has an ecological emphasis or message. So for example, do you ever have them sit outside and observe nature and then reflect on that through their own writings? What type of responses do you receive? Do you experience a lot of resistance to this request, or do they enthusiastically dive in? Or perhaps is it a mixture of both?
Thanks, Carrie. That's a question I think a lot about. And the short answer is yes, I have explored this. And one of the kind of thinking for me that underlies it is all this stuff is already there inside of students, so to speak. I'm a Platonist when it comes to education. It's a lot more about lighting fires than filling buckets. And it really helps in all of this to remember everything is already inside the students. All these potentialities for this relationship, this reciprocity, this connection to Earth and each other, all that's already there. We just have to develop it. And you kind of see it show up. Sam talked about their hunger for meaning making. For your question specifically, I'm even thinking of something as basic as the kind of perennial plea in early spring, can we have class outside? And that's seen as a luxury and a distraction and something that takes away from the real learning. But yes, once in a while, we can have class outside. But I think what they're really after is something a lot deeper, and this almost automatic assumption that class should be outside, that outside is also class. So whenever I can, and that phrase itself, whenever I can, tells a lot about the teacher's mindset, right? Whenever I can, we take class outside, but we'll keep it for now. I designed class to build into that. One example I did with my AP students, we were reading a book called Landmarks by Robert McFarlane, which is a wonderful book. And it's all about relationship between language, nature, place, and where we put our attention. And the book itself is filled with all these old Gaelic and Welsh and so on terms from the United Kingdom that are now gradually becoming extinct. But each of these terms refers to extremely specific natural phenomena. Words like amil, which refers to that casing of ice that gathers on twigs above a stream in wintertime. And the thesis is that having these specific words calls your attention into relationship with this very specific particular place. So with my students, we went outside and I said, go out and develop your own words for really specific natural phenomena you see. And they came back with some beautiful things. One was lur, L-U-R-R, and a student named the sight of wind coming towards you across a lake, but only seeing the ripples that it makes. That's lur. Another one was sisle, S-I-S-T-L-E. This was the student's word for a blade of grass sticking out of snow. And these gorgeous words that they're coming up with of their own creativity, and there's such poetry there. And for me, at least, that seems like that's that spark turning into something hopefully more of like a fire.
That's really cool. I love that idea, Brian, the idea of inventing these words. It's really a way to not just, it's a lot of things it does for you. I mean, it's an exercise in mindfulness, an exercise in the imagination, and it's an exercise that shifts one's consciousness in a really meaningful way, which is why language is so important. Did you have a question, Brian, for someone?
I did. I had a question for Matt. Matt, you and I talk a lot about dreams in our own rich dream lives, which have led to some really fun conversations. But I find for myself, especially as I do more and more dream work, there's this part of me that sometimes gets self-critical. It says, you're spending all this time with your dreams. You should be taking real action out in the real world, doing real things to help address, real problems, right? That sort of self-criticizing voice. And obviously, there are a lot of places where that comes from, a lot of sort of internalized societal biases. But I'm just curious, how do you respond to that? And more specifically, how do you see dream work as part of this radical active engagement to address these, you know, planetary crises?
Oh, wow. Such a fun question. So first of all, as a philosophy student, I should point out the real Scotsman fallacy, but I was looking into dreams initially as part of a comprehensive examination on rewilding and reading this book, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Were? And it was really fascinating because what you saw was the sign interpretation, the ecological signals that living organisms were taking into consideration before they, you know, acted with all of these different levels. And so it occurred to me that these dreams are the sort of point at which these ecological fluctuating cycles of animal bird calls and weather and desires and all the things that inform how animals respond. And so the dream becomes, you know, constituted essentially by the material context in which any sort of behavior takes place or problem is solved and yada, yada. And so in these sort of cycles of reciprocity where waking life experience influences the dream experience, which then influences the next day's waking life experience, I really started being interested in this dream work as sensitizing ourselves to these energy circuits and these relational dynamics that would literally form the neural pathways that are habituated behavior has been shaped over eons. And so reconsidering the human then and the dream as a conduit through which these relations and conflicts of wild spaces and conflict with industry, for instance, or what have you, was erupting, right, in that space. And so this dream work then was able to map these insights and these interventions that people were engaged in as I was reading this literature. And it sort of led these dreams to a point of departure into open inquiry, right? Where you have this multidimensional, transrational approach to revisiting what a sustainable ecosystem is, right? Or how to reconfigure our relationship based on the emotions and the imagery that was sort of coming in. And so you have this sort of psychogeographic analysis of power that is very much related as an extension of this wider community of life and land, where this might be about food you've eaten or meals or issues on next door or relationships at, you know, these different levels, and able to be sensitized to at an unconscious level, right? All of those like hidden structures and violences and tensions that are feeding in to how you live your life in a way that you're not even necessarily conscious of. And then also find ways to practice lived experience outside of the normal logic of a war economy, capitalism, domination, et cetera, and how they guide your emotions, behaviors, and, you know, actions from the sleep into waking life. So, you know, in terms of your questions, I think that it's a place for problem solving, right? It's a place for psychic integration. It's a place where you can be critical of how your daily life is going. And you can keep it in mind as you work to adapt, how you process one day's information and go into the next day, how to act with friends, how to make political decisions, how to dreaming of lesson planning and unconscious things that were I wasn't aware of, were coming into all of these different ways that I express myself. So there's a therapeutic element. There's a way of becoming conscientious of the attitudes and the energies that we're expressing in order to develop a wiser mind. And really with that synthetic and syncretic wisdom, as it moves from the inner world into the outer world, that's part of the process, right, of integration and living your life. And so to your questions of self-criticism, right, that seems to me like what Socrates did, right? The real action, right? The question of, is your mind nature, right? And you're doing ecology essentially by understanding your dreams. And then doing something, what should we be doing? That's, you know, still up for debate. Arguably, we should be doing nothing, right? But so anyway, so these are questions that are coming up, and I would answer your very intelligent question with. Yeah, I think it really comes down to what is it that's shaping our lives and how can we look at ourselves and learn about our context in more holistic and effective ways.
Thank you for that, Matt. Did you have a question for Missy?
Yeah, Missy, I love what you're doing, first of all, with the with Earth Law. And I would love to know what Thomas Berry would have thought as well. But so my question is really, you know, given that these founding charters, right, of these early colonial settlements are based on extraction and profiteering, and these are values around arguably which the United States Constitution was organized. And so you working in the American and international legal systems, I'm curious if you feel as if those systems, if these corporate charters, if these any colonial institution, do you feel as if they're actually capable of addressing the issues of climate destabilization, of mass extinction, of cultural collapse that they arguably drive in the first place? Or is it just inherently unreciprocal, right? And so I guess shorter question would be, what are the ways that we can work within the systems? What are the ways we need to work outside of the systems in order to mitigate and transform the drivers of ecocide and genocide? You know, how do we transform those more effectively in and out of the system?
Well, thanks, Matt. One of the things that gave me a lot of hope from studying Thomas Berry and Brian Swim is their view of the world as an evolutionary cosmos. And so I think we can evolve out of the problems that we got ourselves in. I don't think anyone disagrees that it was property law that's gotten us into the mess we're in. But, you know, at the time, Thomas Jefferson and the other drafters thought they were doing the right thing. And in my view, we don't have to destroy property rights in order to moderate their use. So, for example, zoning ordinances are one of the few things that have made inroads on fracking. The fracking industry has basically exempted itself from all of our major environmental laws. And so we're relying on zoning to actually stop fracking in our local communities. And I also think that we can make indigenous practices of reciprocity real on any property that we own. By our very nature, human beings are empathetic. We understand reciprocity once we see it, and it's just a question of learning what it is and how to make it real. Practices of restoration have become law on private property. And I also think that this whole field of regeneration is really exciting. I personally have spent a lot of time trying to understand it and see where it's popping up all over the world. And keep in mind, there's also some good things in our legal system that actually support an environmental ethic. We have eminent domain, we have the public trust, we have the rights of minority stakeholders. And when you think about it, our Constitution even incorporated indigenous law into it on how to build consensus. So I don't think we should throw it all out, but I do think we should rebalance it. I do think that we should have a representative democracy instead of a democracy that's run by corporate interests. And I mean, I personally think we need to expand the size of the Supreme Court if we're going to get a handle on that. And I agree that nature's essentially become this tradable commodity, but I do see inroads. Corporate inroads are corporate social responsibility and ESG, which is environmental social governance. And to be honest, I don't know a lot about it, but the Earth Law Center is doing a thought leadership conference on that this fall in New York City, where they're going to be speaking with the corporate councils in Manhattan about putting board seats for nature into corporations and helping them work through that. And there's also some really exciting legal inroads. For example, rights of nature in the constitutions of Ecuador. They're also been put into the national law of Panama, and it's actually up for a vote in Chile. The Earth Law Center has been doing thought leadership on guardianship, and a test case will be in Colorado, so that's an exciting new development. We've also developed a new framework for how marine protected areas can own and manage themselves, and this is all in the context of our current legal system. And we're also rewriting courses for law schools and developing continuing education for judges, showing them these leverage points in the legal system where we can create a better future. So I'm actually feeling optimistic about working within the system and building off where it went right and reinventing where it went wrong. So yeah, thanks, Matt.
Thank you for that, Missy. And that's such a great question, Matt. I mean, it's so difficult to find the right balance between working within the system as it is, but also recognizing that the system itself is part of the problem. And I think, you know, I see that as a parent when I think about preparing my children for the world that they were born into. And I think of it, you know, as an educator also, because we have systems in place that our children are going to have to function in some way. But also part of the work is to reimagine those systems. And that's a balance that we have to always kind of grapple with, and we're never quite there. So that leads into our final question in this series that we're doing on education called Reimagine the Classroom. And I want to think about a classroom, not as a physical space, not as something contained by walls, but as a metaphor for the world or a microcosm. In other words, that we teach and learn not just through curriculum and content, but also by the model that we set, by the structures we establish, by the relationships that are put forth and in the learning space, whatever it may be, and also by pedagogical processes. So I want to try to do something like a lightning round here, like have everyone just in a few sentences. I would like you to share, and this is the thing we're doing in all of these episodes in the series, share your vision for a reimagined classroom. What does that look like for you? I want to start with Sam. Go ahead, Sam.
Absolutely. So I'd like to introduce this idea that Thomas Berry brought forth, that the universe is a single multi-form celebratory event. So how do we create practices that both create a sense of collaboration and relationality between learners in the classroom, so they experience themselves as in a collaborative whole while also honoring their differentiated gifts. So honoring other ways of knowing, foregrounding type of model of education that moves beyond the sage on the stage toward a collaborative model where the mind, cognitive development, social emotional learning, and the inner life are all nurtured through the practices that students are co-creating with their teachers.
Thank you, Sam. Carrie, what do you think about the reimagined classroom?
Yeah, I'd love to see a more intergenerational presence, exposing children to more elders, and also better balancing out learning with more concrete experiential type events that happen outside. So whether that's in a school garden, writing eco-poetry, or perhaps even engaging in citizen science for ecosystem restoration.
Thanks, Carrie. Brian?
I have a lot of thoughts on this. I like the idea of aligning school structures and rhythms around natural cycles, integrating learning around a common problem, place, or project that's interdisciplinary. But I also come back to the flipping this question and saying, what if we ask students this question? What kind of school education, et cetera, would they imagine? And I think that's an important question to ask them, because it gives them ownership over their education and can spur that like creative agency and radical imagination that they will need, quote, after school to do this work for themselves and for the world. So any ways to empower them with that boldness and facilitate the development of that creativity needed to execute it.
Thank you, Brian. Matt Switzer, what's your reimagined classroom look like?
Yeah, well, I love the question, and I was trying to think about a nice metaphor. And I really appreciated Thomas Berry's essay, Meadow Across the Creek. And it struck me as a great metaphor for another context, right, of learning and this basic life attitude. Because this meadow is meals for non-humans. It's a place where community comes together. You know, it's a place where 1,000 decisions are coming together in order to make a beautiful place. And so my vision of a reimagined classroom would be a place where we could stop talking. Place where we could use our senses, learn our relations, you know, and consider how billions of years of evolution have shaped the contours of the land and are driving the feeling you have in this place and sitting with that and feeling into it. So what thoughts, sensations are coming up and going from there. So starting with those places you love, finding ways to celebrate creativity as we learn a little bit more about the mystery. So that's my reimagined classroom.
Thank you. And Missy, your reimagined classroom.
Well, I, of course, agree with what everyone else said. But if I had something to add, I'd like to also see a reimagined teacher. I think if you want to build an integrated classroom, you actually have to get integrated within your own self. And so I actually spent the past year trying to do that myself. And what I would suggest is teachers mapping the archetypes in their own psyche, teachers seeing an integrated doctor, teachers working with mandalas, teachers getting tutored in wisdom traditions. And to Carrie's point about an intergenerational learning experience, having teachers actually get mentored by elders themselves, and then bringing that story of their discoveries into their classrooms, I think that would be really inspiring.
Thank you, Missy. And thank you to everyone for joining me today. Missy Lauren, Sam King, Carrie Crisp Vasquez, Brian Pannell, and Matt Switzer. The Integral Education panel, thank you for all your work reimagining our world, reimagining education, and for your wisdom today.
Thanks, Theodore.
Thanks, Theodore.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Theodore.
Thank you, Theodore.
The Reimagining Podcast with Theodore Richards is a production of Wisdom Projects Incorporated. Original music by Cosmos Ray. Sound engineering by Jim Qualick. Thank you for listening and for reimagining with us.